لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، صلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين، أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوان ينصر. In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful. This is session 19 and we are continuing our discussion about lesson 15. We said that there are some concepts which may not look the same as one of the three major types of acquired concepts, or the concepts that we know by al-mahsuli, that is primary intelligibles, secondary philosophical intelligibles, and secondary logical intelligibles. This form of concept, which may not look as one of them, in the end will be known that it's indeed one of the three major types of concepts, and is nothing new, nothing other than them, but it needs some discussion. This is what we call it in Arabic, al-mafahim al-i'tibariyya, and we said that al-i'tibar has different meanings, different usage, and we should be careful not to get confused. In the book, al-i'tibari is translated as respectable. But as I said, I prefer if we use the term i'tibari itself, because it's a very important term, and if we say respectable, it may not fit in with some of the usage. What is important for us here is al-i'tibar in the sense which is the same as value concepts. So here by al-i'tibari we mean a concept which is based on some consideration of value, or you could say we mean value concepts, including both moral concepts and legal concepts. This is the meaning of i'tibar that we are going to discuss here. So i'tibar in other senses, it's not relevant to us here. Inshallah, later we will have some discussions about al-i'tibar, which is related to other senses of the term. For example, when we talk about asalatul wujud, about fundamentality or primordiality of existence, then that is something in contrast to al-i'tibari in another sense. But let's just focus on what is needed here for us in this discussion. So the whole issue is this: how can we classify value concepts? How can we classify ethical and legal concepts called al-i'tibari under one of those three major types of acquired concepts? The reason that has caused this question to be important is that when we use some concepts such as, for example, justice, or such as good and bad, right and wrong, and so on and so forth, we are not able to show to which these concepts refer. If I use, for example, an ordinary primary concept like book, tree, flower, I can say that these things outside are book, tree, and flower. If I use, for example, secondary philosophical concepts like, for example, contingency, necessity, and so on, I can still say that these things outside are, for example, contingent beings, or God the Almighty is necessary being. But where is good and bad outside? Can I say that, for example, when I say justice is good, can I say that this is justice or this is good? So this is the problem. But as I said, this problem is just a problem for those who have not been able to analyze these terms properly. After proper analysis, it will be known that these concepts are also secondary intelligibles, and some of them may be primary intelligibles, and God willing, we are going to talk about it very shortly. So, the whole question for us here about respectable concept or al-mafahim al-i'tibariyya, here the question for us is value concepts, is about the nature of ethical and legal concepts. This is the question. Then the answer which is offered by the author is that these concepts can be discussed, can be studied in different ways, but what is important for us here is to see how these concepts are related to reality, how they can be called objective, how can they be distinguished from fictions, from illusions. We can discuss them in two different phases. In the first phase, if we focus on just predicates, which usually occur in these two disciplines, I mean ethics and law. Usually, when you have a sentence, a proposition in these two disciplines, the predicate is something like, for example, ought or ought not, something like good and bad, something like right and wrong, something like obligation, these things. So if we focus on these things at the beginning, and then we go to discuss in the second phase about the subjects, such as, for example, justice, honesty, and so on and so forth. Regarding the predicates, like, for example, ought and ought not, the author says that some people may think that ought and ought not are not really referring to anything. They are not really objective concepts. They are just something that if we, for example, like something, we say it ought to be done or you ought to do it. It's a matter of just expressing our feelings. And if we don't like something, if we dislike something, if we hate something, to express our dislike, we say, you ought not do that. Some people, emotivists, have said this. But we believe that when we use ought and ought not in ethics and also in law, these refer to something real. Maybe not easily identifiable, maybe not possible to be referred by your finger. You cannot refer at what is referred at by these concepts to the referent. But there is something in reality. But we should know that reality has different realms. Reality has different domains. And those things which are sensual, which can be referred at by our fingers, are only a small part of the reality. So when we say that something is necessary or something ought to be done, we should focus on the concept of ought. Let's first see what does ought mean in other cases. For example, when we say that to have fire, you ought to have, for example, oxygen. What does this ought mean? Is it something real, or it's something just we like to say? Something that is an illusion, a fiction. I think no one can say that this is not a reality. No, definitely this is a reality. In sciences, there are many, many things, many, many facts expressed by the usage of ought or ought not, or for example, saying necessary. For example, a chemist tells the, for example, patient that this medicine ought to be taken in the morning, in the noon, in the evening. What does this ought mean? It means that it has nothing to do with the reality, or it means that according to the science of pharmacology, this is a necessary fact that if you want to recover, if you want to get rid of your illness, you must take this medicine in these times. So this necessity is indeed an expression of a necessary relation that exists between something as a cause and something as an effect. Taking medicine can cause removal of illness. So taking medicine is a cause, removal of illness is an effect, and you know that there is a necessary relation between cause and effect. If you want the effect, you must have the cause. If you have the cause, definitely there will be the effect. So this is the necessary relation between these two. Philosophers have a special technical terms here to refer to these sorts of necessity. And please be very careful and please look at the screen. I will try to explain them as clear as I can. If you look at the screen, please. So we have cause, and we have effect. Like, for example, having medicine and health, or fire and heat. Okay? When there is cause, of course, complete cause, definitely the effect comes. So after having complete cause, necessarily the effect comes into existence. This necessarily, or you could say it is necessary to have the effect, is because of the necessity which exists in causal relation. So whenever there is cause completed, necessarily you will have effect. You can also look at this fact from the other angle, from the other side, and say, whenever the effect, whenever the effect exists, necessarily the cause must have existed. This is also a sort of necessity. So if you have cause, if you have cause, the effect comes. If you want effect, you must bring the cause. So I repeat. If you have the cause, you must have effect. And if you have effect, you must have cause. Okay? Now, these two necessities that we have here are, as you understand, different. We have the necessity of effect, which is caused by the cause, and this is called by Muslim philosophers and in Arabic, al-zarurah bil-ghayra. Al-zarurah bil-ghayr, meaning necessity by other. So, effect becomes necessary, but this necessity is caused by other, by something else, and that is by the cause. And the transliteration is this. Al-Zarura you can say in this way, or you could say in this way, Bil-Ghayr. Okay. This is Al-Zarura Bil-Ghayr. As I said, you can look at this from another aspect, from another angle, from the other side. You could say we have necessity of cause. How? Like saying that if there is heat, necessarily there must be its cause. If you want health, necessarily you must have medicine. This necessity is not caused by effect, because effect cannot have any influence upon the cause. This necessity is understandable from the effect. So if you have some effect, you say that we have this necessity. So this is called al-zarura bil-qiyas, which is al-zarura bil-qiyas ila al-ghayr, if you want it in complete form. Al-zarura bil-qiyas means necessity by relation. I prefer to translate it in this way, unlike what is translated in the book. I think this is more accurate and more understandable. Necessity by relation. So, in also Arabic we call it as darura bil qiyas, and the transliteration is like this. Al-Zarura Bil-Qiyas. Okay? So, if you have cause and then you want to conclude that the effect must be there, this necessity which is given by cause to the effect is al-zarura bil-ghayr, necessity by other. But if there is effect and you want to conclude that there must be cause, so this necessity which is given to cause is called al-zarura bil-qiyas. This is something related to our understanding. Al-zarura bil-qiyas, necessity by relation. Okay? So, now let's go back to the concept of oath. If I say, you ought to have fire to have heat. This ought to have fire is a sort of necessity which is understandable from the effect. So I imagine in my mind heat, and then I say, if you want heat, you must bring the coals, you must bring the fire. So this is called al-darura bil-qiyas. Now let's go to the ethical concepts, or you could say ethical situations, ethical context in which we use the term ought and ought not. For example, if I say you ought to tell truth, you ought to be honest, you ought to keep your promises, what does this oath refer to? This oath means that if you want to reach perfection, if you want to enjoy happy life, you need to bring these things. Because being honest, keeping your promises, and being just and so on, all are causes that can bring about happiness. So if you want that effect, you must bring the causes. In this way, you can easily understand that when we use ought or ought not in morality, it's not arbitrary, it's not baseless, it's not a matter of taste or choice. It's not just an expression of our feeling. No. It is to uncover a necessary relation, a real relation between two things. So if instead of saying telling truth is good or you ought to tell truth, I say you ought to tell lies always. Or I say you ought not to keep your promises. You can evaluate this. You can say, no, this is wrong. You have made a mistake. Because if I tell lies, this and this will happen. No one will trust each other. Social stability will be disturbed. We will not reach happiness. We will not have confidence in our heart. We will not have peace in our heart. We will not have peace in the society. So, you can reject the sentence that you ought to, for example, tell lies or you ought not to keep your promises. So this shows that we have reality, a sort of reality, a realm of reality, a domain of reality, which is related to ethical questions, as well as legal questions. So it's not a matter of just expressing yourself, expressing your feelings or attitudes. So, you do not need to have a physical body outside so that you can say this is something real. Because unfortunately, many people who are preoccupied by our sensual knowledge, by our perceptions, they only can accept something which is visible or audible or touchable. But there are many, many things that we cannot understand by our five senses, but still they are there. Many facts in the sciences are the facts that uncover necessary relation between the things, but those relations themselves cannot be understood by our perceptions, by our senses. This is the case about ought and ought not. And if you are interested in having more discussion about this, I have also discussed this issue in my book, Ethical Relativism. In the final chapter, there is an analysis of the concept like ought and ought not, and good and bad, right and wrong. What about the subjects? We said that we speak in two phases. So, in the first phase, we talked about the predicates, concepts such as ought, ought not, good and bad. Good and bad is the same. Good also means that this can help achieving that cause. If, for example, I say telling truth is good, it means that if you have an ideal, you have an aim, and that is, for example, happiness, telling truth helps to achieve that. So good means this. Bad means this is harmful. It doesn't help. It prevents. It stops. Okay? So, this is about the predicates. What about the subjects? For example, telling truth itself. Or, for example, justice, honesty, and also negative concepts, such as, for example, misery, oppression, usurp. These concepts. Again, these concepts are not conventional in the sense that they are just based on contract, they are just based on our decisions. They are not arbitrary. These concepts are also endowed with some reality, but reality of its own sort. To be able to regulate our social life and even our personal life, we need such concepts. How we derive these concepts, how do we come to these concepts, is something separate. How we may use, for example, the ordinary concepts and then broaden them so that they can include the non-material facts, this is something that we cannot discuss here. How can we, for example, come to suppose concepts such as possession, to possess something, to be possessed, ownership, kingdom, rulership? These concepts are all related to our discussion. These concepts can occur as subjects in ethical or legal propositions or sentences. But here we are not concerned with the way that we derive these concepts. What is important for us is to see whether they are related to the objective world, to reality, whether they enjoy some reality or not. So the author says that these concepts are related to the reality. These are the things that we have brought into the world of concepts. We have made them in our conventions, in our contracts, but based on reality. It's not the same to say whether, for example, keeping promises is good or bad. It's not the same to say oppression is good or bad. If we have made this concept, if we have invented these concepts, it's also a matter of rediscovering something that exists outside. Many of us know this by our nature, but we want to rediscover this, we want to articulate this. If you study the Socrates dialogues, for example, about justice, you see how he wants to bring out the understanding that the opposite party has about, for example, concepts such as justice. So by making questions, he tries to modify the definition that the person has in the beginning and refine that definition and complete it. But he always tries to make that person himself come to that conclusion. It means that we understand these things. We understand that justice is good, and we even understand what is justice. But it's very difficult to articulate that. So these concepts are also real concepts. These are also objective concepts. This is why some people may make mistakes in defining them. If they were just a matter of our own decision, a matter of our own choice, then there was no sense, there was no way to talk about making mistakes. If someone, for example, says that this food is good, meaning that I enjoy this food. Another person says this food is bad in the sense that I don't enjoy this food. Both are right. There's no matter of making mistake. Both are right. Both are expressing their own feelings. But if someone said justice is good and the other person said justice is bad, you don't take it in the way that you take this food is good or bad. So these are also real things. Then the question remains that these ethical and legal concepts are primary intelligibles or secondary intelligibles. The author says that the predicates ought, ought not, good, bad, right, wrong, obligation, these are secondary philosophical intelligibles. These are things that can be applied to the things in reality outside, but these are not related to a mahiyah, to their nature, to their quiddity, to their whatness. And regarding the subject, like justice and so on and so forth, he says that these are sometimes secondary philosophical concepts and sometimes maybe primary, depending on the cases. But in any case, they are not logical concepts, logical intelligibles, because they can be applied to the things outside. You can say this social system is just. If it were a logical concept, we couldn't apply it to the things outside. So I think now we have a clear idea, or relatively clear idea, about the nature of ethical and legal concepts. And again, if you are interested to know more, you can wait till we discuss about this later in this book, or you can refer to the other books which are available, like the book Ethical Relativism, the last chapter. Lesson 16 is about empiricism, and this is very important, and it helps us for our next lessons on epistemology. The author says that one of the main groups of philosophers in the West who have denied universal concepts are positivists. Positivists believe that the concepts that we use are the terms, the words that we use. So we have a language, a mental language, and that mental language which we use does not necessarily imply that there must be a meaning for that. If the terms that we use is related to the things which can be understood by our senses, by perception, then those terms have meaning. If we use something universal, if we use something abstract, spiritual, something related to metaphysics, something related to theology, anything that we cannot perceive by our five senses, then these terms have no meaning. Especially this is very true regarding logical positivism. They say metaphysics and theology are nonsense. They have no meaning. They are meaningless. The propositions that you have in these two disciplines are meaningless. They don't say they are false. No, they say they are meaningless. And it's worse than being false. Because if something is meaningless, then there's no point in judging and evaluating that. So this is the idea of positivists. And they only accept some form of primary intelligibles, those which can be easily understood, those which can be understood by our senses. Otherwise, they don't believe in secondary philosophical intelligibles, they don't believe in secondary logical intelligibles, neither they believe in some of the primary intelligibles which cannot be understood by our senses. And they reduce or they limit our senses only to 5 senses. Because you know, we have an inner sense. We have a sense inside us by which we understand many things. We understand, for example, our happiness, our sadness, and many things. Those things which can be known by a form of knowledge by presence. They don't believe in thisness, at least some of them, or many of them. They don't believe in inner experiences, inner senses. So the realm of truth, the universe of truth for them is very, very limited and very, very narrow. For example, when they come to sociology, people like Auguste Comte, who had this idea of positivism, and he is indeed father of positivism in the modern philosophy, Western philosophy, and he is considered by some people as father of sociology, in the sense that sociology, before becoming a positive science, was not sociology. So they want to deny any form of sociology of theories and understanding in the past. And they say, as soon as it was converted into a positive science by Auguste Comte, so that has become a real sociology. Or for example, about psychology. They say, when we reached this methodology of positivism in psychology, is the beginning of real psychology. And many of them have reduced psychology only to a study of our external behaviors. So many, many important things, many, many profound ideas in psychology which cannot be understood by our senses, they have excluded from psychology. Of course, this behavioral attitude towards psychology, which was very popular in the 60s, is now in decline, and there are many, many aspects of human soul which is now studied by psychology and was not interesting to those people who were positivists. Now let's see what are the problems with positivism. There are 6 objections to positivism mentioned by the author. First of all, positivists do not recognize knowledge by presence. And this is very dangerous, because knowledge by presence is the cornerstone of our knowledge building, our knowledge structure. And if you deny knowledge by presence, then you cannot have any way to guarantee the truth of your ideas. This is something that we discussed before, and inshallah we will discuss again in future. The second objection is that they have based everything on senses. And as you know, the most, I could say, the weakest form of knowledge is the knowledge which we gain by our senses. And you remember that some people, when faced we're faced with the fact that we make mistakes. For example, you remember I had the example of putting your hands in two containers of water, one cold and the other hot, and then putting them together in a moderate water, how you make mistake. So there were some people who were faced with these mistakes in our sensual knowledge, and then they had to find some way to escape, and they couldn't, and then they became skeptical. So perceptual knowledge is very weak, and it's always subject to mistakes, subject to limitations. So these people have denied knowledge by presence, have denied rational and or intellectual knowledge, and they have based their knowledge on something which is vulnerable, which is very weak. The third problem is that they have denied universal concepts, and the problems that we mentioned, the objections that we mentioned about nominalists, again apply to these people. The fourth problem is that they say metaphysical concepts are meaningless. And this is not true, because we understand. I'm not saying that you must endorse metaphysical propositions made by philosophers, but you understand. Whether you deny or you reject, you understand them, and it means that you must believe that they have meaning. Those who say, for example, we don't believe in philosophy, they understand philosophy, and then they deny it. So this is also something important. The other problem is that when you are a positivist and you limit your knowledge to those things which can be understood by senses, then you will lose the whole sense of sciences. Because in sciences we are after necessary rules. We are after universal rules. And something like necessity, universality, cannot be understood by senses. And the final objection is that positivists cannot have a convenient relation with mathematics. They cannot analyze mathematics, because mathematics is something that all human beings endorse. It's one of the most certain and accurate knowledge of mankind. But it's not something that we understand by our senses. Some positivists have tried to respond to this objection by saying that mathematics is related to the mental relation between concepts, and it's indeed a form of secondary logical concept. But this is not true, because secondary logical concepts cannot be applied to the things outside, but mathematics is applicable to the world outside. And many, many things that we do, we use sophisticated mathematics. For example, making machineries, making, for example, space ships, making cars, trains, all these technology, modern technology and modern technological equipments are based on mathematics. So mathematics is related to the external world, and we cannot say that mathematical concepts are just logical concepts. So this is about positivism and about the objections on positivism. Inshallah, we will discuss the remainder of this lesson in the following session. وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.